the source of the greatest sorrow of Keene's life. He poured out his grief in a poem of 22 verses, 8 lines to a verse. The poem was called The Mournful Lute, or Preceptor's Farewell. The untimely death blow of this school was the determination of Payne's first effort to respond in obedience to the heavenly vision to be the educator to his people. With letters of recommendations from friendly whites, Payne sailed from his native home, Charleston, to New York City. Shortly after his arrival in New York, Payne came in contact with the Reverend Daniel Strobel, a minister of the Lutheran Church and a representative of the Society of Inquiry on Missions at Gettysburg Seminary. This society was a student movement originating at Andover Seminary and spreading among other institutions in the North and East. At Gettysburg, the society decided to educate a promising free black youth with the view of preparing him for ministry to the free black people of this country. On reading Payne's recommendations, Reverend Strobel said, "Mr. Payne, I believe you are providentially sent here, for Mr. Martin has just informed me that the Society of Inquiry on Missions at Gettysburg has resolved to educate a talented, pious young man of color for the intellectual, moral, and social elevation of the free colored people in this country. And from these letters, you are the man they want. Now, if you will go to Gettysburg and study theology there, you will be better fitted than you are now for usefulness among your people." Now, this was an unexpected and very generous offer. And yet, for two reasons, Payne was slow in accepting it. One reason was the fact that he had not considered the matter of entering the Christian ministry, for he thought of himself as one who was called to be a teacher. And he had not seen the relationship between being a minister and a teacher. The other reason was a suspicion that the offer was merely a scheme to get him involved in the colonization society of which he had no interest. Being satisfied with the Reverend Strobel's answer on both points, Payne decided to enroll in Gettysburg Seminary. The experience at Gettysburg Seminary became another turning point in Payne's interesting career. They meant two more years of formal education, making a total of 4 years. They meant further preparation for his mission as an educator to his people. They provided the incentive which led him to decide to enter the Christian ministry. At the same time, they gave him training that enabled him to make sufficient contribution to the leadership of the AME Church, which up to that time, he was not a member. What were some of the experiences of Payne at Gettysburg? Payne's journal, to which I had access, reveals the habit of private worship, which had four features. First, he concentrated on the reality of God with special reflection upon his power, goodness, and mercy. Second, he subjected himself to vigorous self-examination in the light of what he considered to be the will of God. Third, he repeatedly expressed a desire to live a holy life, one devoted to God, one characterized by ardent love and unwavering faith. Fourth, the climax of his experience of worship is seen in his recurring acts of self-dedication and consecration to the will and purpose of God. Aside from his studies, Payne was vigorously active in the community and neighboring towns, teaching Sunday school, tutoring private pupils, some of whom developed to become prominent churchmen and educators, organizing and promoting adult groups for both men and women, participating in abolitionist activities, instilling into whom he came in contact the principle of racial pride, self-help, self-initiative, and self-reliance. Due to eye trouble, going back to 1832, Payne withdrew from the seminary in 1837. And although he did not finish his course at Gettysburg Seminary, his training equipped him to become the intellectual leader of the church and the first AME bishop with any formal theological training. As pastor, Payne's pastoral experiences cover a period of about 11 years from 1837 to 1848. When he left Gettysburg Seminary, his plan was to enter the AME ministry. The plan was delayed, until 1840, due to his acceptance of the pastoral call by the Presbyterian Church in Troy, New York. From Troy, New York, he went in 1840 to Philadelphia, where he entered the ministry of the AME Church and became associate pastor of Mother Bethel Church, of which Bishop Morris Brown was pastor. Other points of his pastorate were Israel Church in Washington, D.C., and Bethel in Baltimore. As a pastor and later as a bishop, Payne took over the moral, the spiritual, and intellectual leadership of the AME Church. In Philadelphia, he organized and conducted a theological association. In Washington, he organized and promoted Mothers Club, literary and historical associations. In order to help preachers, he superintended revival services. And after a preacher had presented his message at the revival, Payne counseled with him, pointing out his strong points and his weaknesses and lines of improvement. On the whole, Payne's impression of these sermons were very unfavorable. The following are some of comments which he made concerning the preachers. Brother Tillman lacks perspicuity. He needs to know the meaning of words. Brother Bassett is intelligent, but lacks the power of divine unction and the saving power of the Holy Spirit. The brother from Delaware is earnest and sincere, but he is too boisterous. The sermon by the bishop was practical and instructive. Brother Collins was very verbose. His introduction was a half hour long. The sermon was an hour long. He rode roughshod over his people. Brother Harris was very spiritual in his remarks. Brother Wilkerson is an intelligent preacher, but he is too boisterous for a protracted meeting. And this is the last one. Brother Baker preached in his usual vague and indefinite manner. This brother, I believe, is a good man and means to do well, but he is one of the most unintelligible preachers I've ever heard. He makes use of words that cannot be found in any language under the sun. That was a young educator, one who's called to be an educator to his people. In 1843, Paine wrote and published in the Quarterly Magazine, the forerunner of what is now known as the Christian Recorder of the AME Church, a series of epistles on the education of the ministry. He followed up these epistles with the resolution at the General Conference of 1844 to do something about the training of ministers. The General Conference adopted the resolution, thereby bringing into being the annual conference course of studies for admission to the conference and for ordination of deacon and elder. This act laid the foundation for the beginning of theological schools sponsored by the church, and the first one of which was Union Seminary in Ohio. In this General Conference of 1844 and in subsequent ones, Paine was the leading spirit that brought into existence other departments of the AME denomination. It is most remarkable to note that Paine was elected bishop only 9 years after he joined the annual conference of the AME Church in Philadelphia. It is also worthy of note that his election was a sharp contrast from the pattern of the day. Never was he a candidate. He had no Episcopal aspirations. He denounced simony and bribery as deadly evils in the church. In 1848, before he was elected, he definitely refused to allow his name to be used in the election. By the time of the General Conference of 1852, his brethren had decided to make him a bishop, whether he wanted to or not. They saw in him a man of outstanding force of character and inner vitality. They were profoundly impressed by his deep religious convictions. Moreover, Bishop Paul Quinn appointed him to preach the opening sermon of the General Conference of 1852, and he took as his text the passage from the 2 Corinthians, "Who is sufficient for these things?" And after pointing out who is not sufficient for these things, he indicated that he only is sufficient for these things who make Christ the model of his own Christian and ministerial character. This sermon is said to have elected him. As a bishop, Paine served for 41 years, 21 of which he was senior bishop. As an Episcopal administrator, he traveled far and wide planting the AME Church among the blacks wherever they could be found. Before the end of the Civil War, he was a trailblazer of the African Methodism in the South, first among the slaves and then among the freedmen. He represented the church in several times in Europe at ecumenical gatherings. He met President Abraham Lincoln at the White House and urged him to sign the bill which abolished slavery in the District of Columbia. But the crowning work of Paine was the founding of Wilberforce University. This adventure was an act of heroic moral courage, resolute will, and robust religious faith. For without funds and without the authority of the annual conferences, when the hour of decision came, Paine rose up to the occasion and said, "In the name of the Lord, I buy the property of Wilberforce for the AME Church." The cost of $10,000, which was very reasonable, had to be paid within 3 months. Was this impractical? Not for Daniel Paine. for he mobilized the forces of three annual conferences and responded, which responded with the full payment of the cost on scheduled time. Payne set forth, or set about to convert Wilberforce, which had the status then of an elementary school, into Wilberforce University with seven departments from elementary to higher education, including the professional training of law and medicine. And he became the first president and served for 14 years. This man, who only had 4 years of formal training himself. Payne's teaching ministry. As an apostle of Christian education, Daniel Alexander Payne was always keenly aware of and responded to his divine call to be a teacher. In essence, his message was obedience to that commandment which says, "Thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy mind." He was interested in liberation through brain power. This is not to be understood that he disregarded the other aspects of the commandment, which call for loving God with the other faculties, heart, soul, strength, and a neighbor as oneself. But the focus of his teaching was on loving God with all of one's mental powers. His teaching may be classified into four broad categories: Christian education, the ministry, ethics, and worship. And I'm just going to lift up just one aspect of his ethical teaching. For Payne, the motive of human action is to be holy, as God is holy. With the sense of holiness in his mind, Payne had nothing but uncompromising condemnation for political aspirations in the church, for politics and other unscrupulous practices. For him, these were deadly sins. And to his death in 1893, he won the church against these evils. And it's a pity that that warning had not been heeded. One more observation. Payne was the victim of the dehumanizing system of slavery and of second-class citizenship, which followed during the Reconstruction and post-Reconstruction period. He lived through the period when revolutionary forces of the post-Reconstruction period reduced the effectiveness of the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments and made the lot of black people almost what it was before slavery was abolished officially. And yet, Payne did not teach, nor did he resort to retaliation. He was a man without bitterness. He lived by and taught the principles: be not overcome, amen, by evil. Amen. Take the positive. Overcome evil with goodness. And finally, Payne's heritage. What is the heritage of Bishop Daniel Alexander Payne? As I see it, I want to state this heritage in 4 points. Payne spearheaded most of the ME Church's progress from about 1842 to 1880. In so doing, he brought about the advancement of the church from obscurity to a position of power and influence. Secondly, Payne gave us Wilberforce University, the first black institution of higher learning owned, operated, and controlled by blacks, the fruits of which were the birth of other denominational institutions in this country as well as abroad. Third, more than any other person that I know, Payne instilled within the black race the philosophy of self-help, self-initiative, and self-reliance. Number four, as a guide in human relation, Paine left us with the motto, God our Father, Christ our Redeemer, and man our brother. In the 11th chapter of the Epistle to the Hebrews, the author gives brief glimpses of the nation's forerunners. In graphic and summarized statements, he describes the experiences of these heroes of faith. He tells of their long hopes, their worthy goals, their distinctive contributions through faith, the hardship which they endured, their exposure to the lions in the arena, their undaunted facing of death through torture, their refusal to compromise, their unwillingness to concede to the wishes of their persecutors. Concerning one of them, he wrote, it was because of his faith that Abel made a better sacrifice to God than Cain. And he had evidence that God looked upon him as a righteous man whose gifts he could accept. And though Cain killed him, yet by his faith he still speaks to us today. This passage simply suggests that although Daniel Paine lived in the 19th century and has passed on to his great reward, through his faith and the heritage he left us, he still speaks to us today. Let us therefore lay aside every encumbrance and the sin that so readily entangles our feet, and let us run with patient endurance the race that is set before us, looking unto Jesus. I repeat that. Looking unto Jesus. Not some 19th or 20th century racist, whether black or white. Looking unto Jesus. Not a Black Panther. Not a Black Muslim. Not Elridge Cleaver. Not Stokely Carmichael. Not Ralph Brown, Malcolm X, or Elijah Muhammad. Not even Lester Maddox. Or Richard Nixon, but looking unto Jesus as the author and finisher of our faith, Jesus, the Son of God, Jesus, in whom God was reconciling the world unto himself, Jesus, whose name and influence has spread more widely than any other human being on this planet, and whose message has traveled farther around the world than any other leader. Looking unto Jesus, therefore, the author and finisher of our faith.
Thank you.
Now unto him who is able to keep you from falling and to present you faultless before his throne in glory with exceeding joy, to the only wise God, our Savior, be dominion and honor, power and glory, both now and forever. Amen. Amen.
don't you doubt that.
He did. He loved them. He didn't say as much as I think he knew. Even I knew as little late. That as late as 1860, there were only 100,000 Southern white families that had enough slaves to make any money off them. There were at least 4.5 million Southerners who had been ruined by slavery. They couldn't compete with the big slave plantations. They couldn't get enough money, therefore, to pay off their mortgages. Again and again, they lost their farms. And if shortly after the Civil War, you had gone up into the foothills of the mountains in West Virginia, in Virginia, Tennessee, you would have found them squatting up there. Light, happy, very poorly housed animals, eating berries, nuts, and having a great time with the rabbits and the rattlesnakes. The slave masters themselves used to say to their slaves, now look here, let me put some sense in you. Don't you ever have anything to do with that poor white trash. They've got no farm, got no money, got no sense, got no nothing. Stay away from them. Stay away from them. They didn't let them have anything to do with the government. They didn't let them have any schools. They let them have nothing but a few jobs in which they could use the whip.
Oh, they said it when you talk here. I know what you think now. You think that both of us, in fact, all three of us here, are just about as close to the gallows as we're going to ever be without getting there. And if we don't get out of here, we're going to be closer than that. And then they looked at him and laughed and said, no, we don't think that. If it's left to you to hang, there'll be no hanging. The way he loved them. At any time he thought he could have done it and succeeded, he would have said, now let's forget everything. Throw it old musket away. Spit out your tobacco and spit out all those cuss words. And come on over here and sit down. Let's rebuild. All he wanted to do till he died. He loved them. Never lost confidence. He had your prodigal son. Would come home. He always had his eyes skinned. Looking for. None of us were able to hear his last.
so we can have that great government of the people. By the people, for the people. Committed to the proposition that all men are created equal and loved. Now he got in there, and to his astonishment, nothing that he could say. He was telling the truth when he told the Southerners, "I don't intend to bother you slaves in Georgia, Mississippi, Alabama. I don't intend to do it because I don't have any power to do it. I read the Constitution of the United States. Don't think I don't want to do it. Yes, I want to do it. I've been wanting to do it all my life. I would do it way with all of it this minute if I could, but I don't see that I have the power to do it. And since I made an agreement with you when we made this Constitution together, then I intend that whether you see me or see me not, old Abe is going to be trusted. And if I tell you I'm not going to bother your slaves in Georgia, and Mississippi, and Alabama, Virginia, then Abe's word is good. And he will live or die by that word. How come us to get the Emancipation Proclamation then? Why, the Southerners were whooping Uncle Sam. And when Abe asked a lot of his friends how come they were doing it, why, they said, "Abe, you ought to put on an anonymous coat of some kind and just go down there and watch the back part of the line. Say they got 4.5 million slaves. Here come 100,000 slaves with 100,000 mules, horses, loads of chicken, loads of fodder, loads of grain, supplying the Southern Army. Go down a little further than 100,000 more. They've got 4 million men, giving them all kind of supplies a day. And if some of them got guns, and if they're getting a hold, they shoot." You know, when Abe heard that, he didn't call the captain. He went off to report to his commander-in-chief. He went into the closet and saluted and said, "Father, I see that you have vetoed my plan. If you'd have left it to me, I was just going to stop slavery at the border. But I see what you want. You want all of these slaves freed right now. And you were showing me right here in front of my eyes that if I don't free them, you're going to whip the Union and ruin it with the very slaves that we're fighting about." "All right," he said, "I accept the veto." "I abandoned my plan right here. I'm going and write the Emancipation Proclamation right now. Just give me a little victory, put it out on. I don't want to lose a battle and then issue the proclamation." "Give me a little victory. Give me a little rise," as the boys would say. "Give me a little rise, and I'll issue it." Now that's how he came to do it. He felt that the eternal God had vetoed. He'd been thinking about himself as president all the time. And when it was only when he got to thinking about himself as commander-in-chief that he got scared and went to look for the main man as commander-in-chief. "Tell him I'm vetoed and I know it. My plan's done with. I abandoned it. Your plan's on. The first announcement will be made after the first victory. Let me have it soon." Now that's the way we all came free. But it was the anger, the deadly bitterness, and and revolutionary ardor, even until death on the part of the slaveholders, that did it. His intent was not to fire a gun. He even conceived that it might take 100 years for slavery to die in the southern states. But he conceived that in that time, it would be a quiet and consenting death, with the southern hearts already made mellow, and the brotherhood between southerners and northerners cemented again, and the great government of the people, for the people, committed to the proposition that all men are free and free equal, would be going there. No? You see how true it is, every man who has worked hard and suffered greatly knows that no campaign can be seen through from beginning to end. You start by your mind and your heart telling the story. And the issues of battle will tell you when the plan has changed. Abe, the president, started out to stop the war. Abe, the lieutenant of the commander-in-chief in a losing army, saw that he had to strike one blow, and it would be sufficient. He not only struck that blow, but on April the 9th, 1865, he put his hand to the 13th Amendment of the Constitution and sent it to both houses before he died. So you remember this, that you are free today because a poor white man of mostly unpressed breeches, with a loose coat that hung off from the awkward old body, with a face not handsome to see, deeply serious and often depressed, with a voice which you may have thought was going to be a thunder call when he opened his mouth, but came forth with almost a squeak, one who had an almost incontrollable power over the souls of men, because he had meditated so long upon the empire of the he had lived so long, fascinated by the possibility of setting loose upon this earth, of the people, for the people, and by the people, committed to the proposition that all men are free. Cultivated part of the eastern shore of America with the most educated and cultured minds in Massachusetts and New York and New Jersey, men of wealth and substance and power who came there to sniggle and laugh, but who, when he raised his hand in the passion of his soul, became clear, couldn't take that eye. And when he told them the 4 or 5 things that had to be done, they rose as if they had been commanded and got up and went to do it, because they were driven by a presence himself told them that could not be resisted. I love him. I love him. Every time I read some more about him, I love him. This Charnwood book I tell you about can be bought for When he ends up what he has to say about AIDS, he says he is the greatest man connected with popular government in the history of the world. And then he stops. But he says he was not of them. He was not of this world. He dwelt. I've already talked too long, but I have thus far told you only about two great moments in the history of this country. Both of them connected with the rational intelligence, wedding democratic institutions with radical ethics. Now I'm going to tell you why the other one is going on right now. But it's not the president. It's not the Congress. It's going on so quiet that you hardly know it's being done. But it's being done more subtly than at any other time in this country. It's being done by men who have a depth of conviction and an unequivocal ardor for the dignity and immeasurable possibility of an individual human being. It's being done by the Chief Justice and the 9 members of the Supreme Court of the United States. As I look over the last 25 years, I see that as late as 1917, the American soul had so chickened itself again that it had turned back on every group action that Lincoln and the Congress had done, and we were walking in a of Supreme Court and governmentally approved segregation and discrimination like a sea of mud. Now I'm going to tell you something. A man told me not to tell you when he died. You know who studied justice? Told me I couldn't talk about it till he died. When I first went to Howard University, one of my friends had given me that great book by Abram Flexner on the scientific foundations of medicine. And when the accrediting agency first came and knocked me at the pieces and showed me that my medicine was, as the Chinese would say, a paper tiger, I knew what to do. One of the first things I did at Howard University was to invite the accrediting agencies. Please sit down, I said. And I stepped ahead and said, don't come here complimenting me. I haven't done anything. I'm just, I didn't make the institution. And it won't kill me if you tell me that my medical school isn't any cop. I never will know any different if you don't tell me so. First man came to examine my medical school, said to me, "Now, doctor," I said, "what kind of examination you going to?" He'd been there for 2 days and hadn't been to see me. I was afraid he would examine and leave before he saw me at all. And I said to him, "Mr. Secretary, what kind of examination you going to give me?" "Oh," he said, "I'm going to give you a thorough examination." He said, "I'm going to give you a thorough examination." He said, "Well, of course, I'm going to make certain allowances for you." I talked to my head and I said, "Allowances?" He said, "Yes." says you don't have any. Said, but of course, no use me to worry you about that. Said, most of your men will be waiting. In fact, all of them will be waiting on colored people. They don't know the difference between a doctor who's had training in the pre-medical science and a man who hasn't had it. They just want him to come on with what he has as quickly as possible. I sat there and questioned him, and I found out there were 16 requirements for first-class medical school that he was going to let me off on. And I kept on and just thanked him and thanked him. I said, "You're through now?" He said, "Yes." I said, "You know what I'd like you to do?" He said, "What?" He said, "What?" I said, "Take out your pencil now and write a memorandum in which you make note of all 16 of those things. Now look at it carefully to be sure you got everything on there, and throw it in the wastebasket." I said, "You're getting ready to kill me." He said, "How in the world will I ever have a first-class medical school if you start out telling me you're going to let me off on 16 of the ordinary requirements for a first-class school? You don't want to require me to have them at all." Then he got so angry that he cussed. He says, "Blankety blank, blank, blankety blank," he says. "That's the way you talk. Let me tell you something. Let me tell you something. Any first-class medical school has got to have at least 15 men in the preclinical science of medicine that have not only the MD degree, but their PhD degree, and you haven't got a blankety blank one." I said, "Thank you, sir, for the cussing as well as the information." I said, "Now when you write your report, put the information in there. If you still feel like cussing, write that away." I went right on back to flexing his book and made me up a program to train 15 men in the 6 major preclinical sciences. Asked the General Education Board for $75,000 to do it. And they gave it to me. Gave it to me. But when I got to law, I didn't know anything. And when they shot the props out of my law school, I thought I was about to get to be a first-class law school. The first thing the man said to me was, "It is impossible for a 4-year night school ever to be a first-class school unless it's built on top of a day school. And you haven't got anything going on in the day." And I was so terribly upset. I'm getting to a big story, and I'm going to tell you, and then I'm going to sit down. I was so terribly excited, and I didn't have time to read then. The man was right there. And I remembered suddenly that I had a great teacher in New York. His name was Walter Rauschenbusch, whose son had married the daughter of Justice Brandeis. I said, "Dad, if I call up Mr. Justice Brandeis and tell him that I'm a pupil and a lover of Walter, could I see him right away? He'll tell me yes." And he did. Gave me an engagement the next Wednesday. Then I went there and told him what the man was doing to my honorable law school, and it's a piece up there before my eyes. And I didn't know what to do. If he was in my place, what would he do? Thank God for what he said to me. He said, "Mr. Johnson, I'm glad you have come to me, for I have something to say to you." He said, "I know your law school." He said, "For some years now, you've been training a number of men to pass the bar, and they have done well, so many of them. Mr. Johnson, you belong to a minority. that never has laid a hold on its basic civil and constitutional rights. You can't afford to have a law school that trained men to pass the bar. Mr. Johnson, every civil and constitutional right that your people need for first-class citizenship is in that Constitution. But you don't know how to get them out of that. Said one of the saddest things that I have to look at in my life is time and time again see a case coming up into that Supreme Court that involves the most fundamental civil and constitutional rights of your people. So poorly prepared by both white and Negro lawyers that almost invariably the case has to be thrown out without the members of the court getting a chance even to look at the constitutional issue. He said, Mr. Johnson, there's nothing more tragic than that that ever happens in the United States of America. Now, he said, I'm going to tell you something that you can't mention until I die. I know every man on this court. I not only know that your civil and constitutional rights are in that Constitution, but I know them well enough to know that if you ever learn how to come there and bring the case that has a constitutional issue unequivocally clear, one by one they'll give you every one of your basic constitutional rights. Now, if I were you, I'd get rid of that evening law school. You can't do what you've got to do with the part-time services of any group of men, however great they are, and little different where they came from. I'd get the deans of the great law schools of this country. Give me the names and addresses of the best 10 young Negroes that they've had come there in the last 10 or 15 years who in the first place had a first class bachelor's degree. In the second case, either stood at the top of the class or near the top of the class and were known by them to be men of unquestionable integrity. I'd pick me out at least 6 or 7 of those young men and I'd put them in control of my faculty. And I'd say to them, I want you to teach these students how to recognize a constitutional issue in the courts of first resort, how to nurture that case up through the courts of intermediate resort, until when you get to the Supreme Court, the constitutional issue's out there like the back of a razorback hog. I said, I wouldn't pay any attention to numbers of students. I'd pick my students the same way I pick my faculty. I'd pick out a handful of the finest minds I could get. And I'd do it. Well, to make a long story short, that's what I did. Yes. When I pushed the faculty to help me, they all resigned in a body. I had one man left who understood me, Charlie Houston. Called Charlie to him and said, Charlie, got one of the finest minds in the United States. Ever could to you what you might do for the master? People, if you turn your mind entirely into the question of that civil and constitutional rights, I can see him now standing up in my little office, up against it. Yes, Scott, he says, I've often thought of it, but I can't do it. He said, really, I ought to be telling you something I came here to tell you now, and I didn't tell it. Now they're old. They don't own their home, don't own anything. I've got to get out from here and make some money. But a few days after that, as God would have it, Roosevelt came into power and made his father and sister Attorney General of the United States. Set him free just like that. And I got Charlie. And we got Hasty, and we got Ransom, and we got Mabry. started giving a course, the first of its kind ever given in the history of the United States. List all of the cases affecting the civil and constitutional rights of Negroes that are going to courts of last resort. Let us study why they have failed. Each man of you select one such case and hand me an attorney paper which not only tells why this case failed, but give me a legal hypothesis on the basis of which it can be won. Beautiful thing I did is Spotswood Robinson here. He gave Spotswood Robinson restrictive covenants privately agreed upon. Spot said he studied that for 6 months. Came back and said, "Pastor Maybrick," said, "What?" So I've been studying this case for 6 months, and I've concluded there is no hypothesis on the basis of which that case cannot be won. Now, you all will pardon me if I tell you, if you know Jim Neighbors, you know his father was a preacher, and that Neighbors has had the Bible lying around where he could touch it all his life. But you, knowing Neighbors as well as I do, you'd be astonished to hear the answer that he came up with. He looked at him and said, "Mr. Robinson, there's no such thing as the impossibility of finding a tenable hypothesis for a just cause. You'll go back and study 6 months more. Bring me that hypothesis." Spot studied 6 months more and brought the hypothesis. You look up the right books of the Supreme Court decision, you find it's Spot's hypothesis that killed all restrictive covenants arrived at. And that young fella, well, he was so young they didn't have money for the down payment on his house. He had the largest and most complex and diversified group of civil rights victories ever to be had by a man in the history of the United States before he had money enough to be able to make a down payment on his home. Little wife walking around with him, half starved to death, wearing the same old dress. Every time I used to meet her, I used to feel like going up to her and say, "God bless you," and I did again and again. "Spots couldn't do this," I said, "if it wasn't for you, but you were just one of those women that can love the soul of a man. And there's nothing that you won't do. See him carry through the conflict that he's carrying through." Now the upshot of it was, we went on, I can't tell you the whole thing, I'm going to write it. Houston then went on to become chief counsel for the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. Had Hasty by his side, Ransom of Ohio on the other, Maine on the other. The next time we were examined by the University of North Carolina, the head of the law school said, "Confound Johnson. You got 4 men on your law faculty there. Except if they weren't colored, I'd take every confounded one of them." Finest men in this country. And you know what they did?
This is history.
Then the boys at the school said to him, "Now, Houston, whenever you have a man